Welcome to Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project. You can find us online at sacradoctrinaproject.org. I'm Father Dylan Schrader.
I'm Ryan Brady.
I'm William Deem.
And I am Matthew Duganzik.
Today we're going to be speaking about a topic in moral theology, looking at the perverted faculty argument. So this is an argument sometimes made, especially in the area of bioethics, but also in other areas as well, by looking at the natural capacities, abilities, or tendencies of the human person, and specifically considering that the person has a collection of various powers or faculties. Those faculties of their nature are meant to do certain things. So, for example, the eyes are for seeing, the feet are for walking, and so forth. So the perverted faculty argument in its general outline argues that to misuse one of these faculties is essentially immoral. That is, to use one of our natural built-in capacities for something other than its built-in purpose renders that action unethical or immoral. So this kind of argument is often made in bioethics with things like contraception, but also in other areas. So one application would be to argue that it's always wrong to lie, and other things along those lines. So to give us a little more detailed summary of the argument, I'll turn it over to Matthew.
Thank you, Father. That was a helpful introduction. As you were speaking, I was thinking about what I was going to say, and you actually said one of the things that I was about to spit out, which is that the perverted faculty argument is most commonly used, not just in bioethics, but in particular for topics that relate to sex and also for lying. I do think that it has broader applications than that, obviously, but those are the two instances where it comes into play most commonly. But anyway, to backtrack a little bit, the thing is that all natural lawyers agree, and I seem to think everyone here agrees, that what is against human nature is bad for human beings. But the difficulty is trying to figure out what counts as being against human nature, because nature is a broad and analogous concept. And so the perverted faculty argument often serves as a proxy for helping us narrow down or understanding what counts as being against nature in one way or another. The difficulty is pretty easy to demonstrate. If you say, for example, that you think that homosexual acts are wrong because they're unnatural, it's very easy to meet this with a simple rejoinder. Say, for example, you know, is walking on your hands natural? No, therefore, is it wrong? Well, no. Or, you know, playing the lute, playing the guitar with your hands, is that natural? Well, not really, but it doesn't seem morally wrong either. This kind of rejoinder is related to a problem that was characteristic of moral theologies 50 plus years ago. That's called physicalism, which would be to take one of the parts of the body, such as the hands or even some physiological function of the body, and endow it with moral normativity. And consequently, you might end up saying something like it's wrong to drink diet soda because it doesn't give you any nutrition. So this is obviously a bad way of looking at things. But the question then is, what is the right way to look at things? And it seems to me that the right way to look at things is to look at the faculty of the soul, the faculties of the soul rather than the parts of the body. And so if we think about the faculties of the soul, we can understand them as the powers of the soul, what the soul is able to do. And the soul has powers, it has faculties in order to aim at things that are good for it. So any action that would act in such a way that the person would be inhibited from attaining the end of his faculties, any particular faculty, would thereby be bad because it would be clearly against that person's nature. So that, broadly speaking, I think that is the correct formulation of the perverted faculty argument. I don't know if there is such a thing as a standard formulation of it. It seems to be described many different ways by many different people. But broadly speaking, I think that's it, and I think it's correct. So perhaps after me, William can explain why he may or may not like what it is that I've said, and then we can try and clarify things from there.
Yeah, so the general structure of the perverted faculty argument, and I think that this meshes with what both of you have said, is we start with an understanding of human teleology and the purpose of the parts that constitute human nature, you know, the particular faculties wherewith we are naturally endowed. And from that, we move to an understanding of what is good for human nature, or good for bearers of human nature, good for humans, fulfilling of us, perfective of us, in accordance with that nature, tending toward that end that we are by nature ordered towards. And then having determined what is good for us as humans, we can then make a conclusion, draw a conclusion, that the opposite of that is evil or something like that, right? What is positively opposed to that good is therefore evil. And then we can draw a moral normative conclusion about what we ought or ought not do. So does that seem fair? Have I grossly distorted or caricaturized the argument so far?
I think that's accurate. I do think that's accurate of at least some formulations of the perverted faculty argument. I would probably want to broaden it a little bit, but we'll let you keep going with that.
All right, great. Okay. So I'm not completely going after straw men. Okay. Well then I'll press on. And the problem that I have with that, the reason that I think that falls short, is that I think it has an equivocal middle term. I think that specifically the concept of good that's being used in that kind of argument, in the first part of the argument, we're using a specific concept of good that's drawn from teleology and drawn from the purpose of human nature. And then in the second half of that argument, we're using a certainly a related and an analogous concept of good, but it's a particularly moral sort of good. It's the sort of moral good that's the opposite of moral evil. And specifically moral good in the sense of morally obligatory or mm-hmm. that sort of good whose opposite is morally evil. And I think that those are two separate concepts. Again, I think that they're certainly related. There's no question of that, but I think that in principle, they're distinct concepts. And I think that to make the argument work, we would have to specify what that relationship is between those two concepts. And I think that once you start specifying what that relationship is, you find that good in the sense of perfective of human nature, just considered in itself, actually depends on the concept of good as morally obligatory. And so if you're going to have a full concept of human nature, you need to have that moral content already there. And moving the other direction is troublesome, problematic. So that's somewhat general, but that's the objection that I have to the argument as I am familiar with it.
It seems to me that the argument, as you're describing it, would be used to make the case that you are supposed to pursue particular goods.
The argument I'm making or the argument that I'm summarizing to rebut?
The latter.
Okay. They'll have to tease that out a little bit because, you know, they're not saying that that we have a positive obligation to procreate, right, or something like that, but they're saying, yeah, that this is, yeah, I didn't mean to force them into that.
But it would be saying that we have an obligation not to contradict certain, right, faculties, so that granted that the human person has a variety of systems, both spiritual and physical, if we choose to make use of those things, we must make use of them in a way in accordance with their built-in nature.
Right. So it's more an obligation not to pervert the faculty than an obligation to use the faculty well. I mean, you could say an obligation to use the faculty well when you use it, right? But it's not an obligation to perform any particular action.
Right. And I think we're going to run into that pretty broadly anytime we're talking at least about, you know, speaking within the universe of Catholic theology, because I think that that's more or less, you know, that's the end that we all agree we have to end up at. So if our, you know, moral arguments take us somewhere else and, you know, tell us that we have a moral obligation to, you know, have 12 kids, full stop,
yes,
regardless of state and life, then we have a problem.
So William, where do you think we get the concept of moral obligation from, if it's not by looking to our inclinations, seeing an order among them, seeing the way our faculties are ordered and what's best for our thriving as human beings, and then going from there? I mean, for me, all knowledge comes through the senses, and that includes moral knowledge. So we're going to look at the senses, through our senses, we're going to perceive the way we're made, what our faculties are like, and then come to some kind of moral theory that may be in some way deontological, but you can't get deontological ideas without looking at our faculties. And it seems like you're wanting to say that's not accurate, or am I misunderstanding?
And that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about precisely how to trace this knowledge back to the senses themselves. And I'm not trying to say that moral knowledge is completely independent of human nature. You know, I mean, I think that we know what's good for us in that first sense, precisely by knowing human nature, right? So I'm not saying that there's no sense in a teleological understanding of human good. I think that there absolutely is. It's just that I think that there's a distinction between that kind of good and the kind of good that yields moral obligation. But your question, I mean, the question you started with, again, I don't know how to trace obligation back to the senses. I don't know quite how what route I would take there. You know, certainly Aquinas would say you've got to be able to do that. And I'm not sure precisely how I would do that. It's a question worth investigating. I don't have anything intelligent to say, so I'll stop trying. But I will. You know, you say, well, what is obligation and how do we come to know it? I think that's precisely the question that we should be starting with when we start evaluating an argument like this. Like, what is the obligation that we're trying to reach as our conclusion? Because once we've specked out what that is, then we have some foundation for deciding whether or not an argument has actually gotten us there or not.
So if I understand, in other words, moral obligation has to be something more than just a description that acting in certain ways is good for me or bad for me.
Yeah, I think so.
I think I can perhaps advance the conversation by drawing a distinction between positive and negative obligations. I think it's pretty clear that just because we have an inclination to some particular good, maybe procreation or what have you, that does not mean that we always or even ever have to act in view of that particular inclination. But it does mean that it would definitely preclude actions that would... I'll say it like this. I think the perverted faculty argument is very good at coming up with negative moral obligations, but not positive ones. And the reason for that is because, as Aquinas says many times, positive norms, positive moral obligations are always open-ended. They're not binding they don't require you to act in every moment, but they require you to act when the situation calls for it. And it's a matter of prudence to determine when that is. But negative norms are always binding because they're something that's always bad for you. And consequently, although we can't say that perhaps just because something is good for you, that means that you have to do it, we can say that because something is bad for you, you shouldn't ever do it.
Yeah, I appreciate the distinction. I don't know that that's getting addressing my concern. Like, so let me illustrate for you the concern that I have. I may have run this past you before, but if let me say I'm considering a hypothetical act, okay? And let's say that I'm a little bit twisted, and I'm considering the possibility of kidnapping someone and, you know, taking him back to a specially constructed torture chamber and just, you know, doing what you do to somebody who's tied up in a torture chamber for a couple of days. You know, so I'm considering doing this. And as I'm considering doing it, it occurs to me, you know, should I do this? Is this something that's moral to do? And, you know, I think that I can answer that question with certitude, with no ambiguity, without ever considering whether it is going to be perfective of me, bring me closer to my happiness or not. Of course, I think that it would not bring me close to my happiness. I think that it's opposed to my nature as a human, but I don't think that I need to consider that in order to see that it's wrong.
I don't think that the perverted faculty argument, go on.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't mean to say that that was a version of the perverted faculty argument. I was using that to illustrate my more general point about obligation and what
I think I understand your point. But what I was going to say is that if you accept the validity of the perverted faculty argument, that does not mean that every time you think about human action, you have to use it. It also doesn't mean that every time you think about human action, you actually have to think about happiness. You could, in theory, understand that negative moral obligations are in fact do require you to not to do certain things because they are inhibitive of your happiness. But you don't need to understand that in order to understand that you shouldn't do things.
Wait, so what's the distinction between the two? Because, I mean, are you just drawing attention
I think what you're implying is that if you accept the validity of the perverted faculty argument, then you have to be able to make a case that for something to be good or bad, you have to think of it as good or bad for you or with respect to your happiness. I don't think you have to do that.
You mean at the moment that you're deliberating, or do you mean? Yeah, no, I don't mean that. I just mean as a matter of principle. I don't think you ever have to ask that question.
Not right? But you mean theoretically?
Yeah, I think that you can arrive at the conclusion that these are X or bad.
Well, then this becomes a question. Suddenly, we've just gone from ethics to metaethics. Now I need to ask what good and evil are. So go ahead, tell me.
Yeah, I'd seen this going more as me attacking a particular argument, and I'm being called upon to defend things from the ground up. Okay, so you want my account of obligation? Okay, fine. I think
I want your account of what makes an action evil.
Okay, I think that an act is morally evil. Well, I think that we understand an act to be morally evil, and so what's required for us to violate conscience? Okay, so yeah, I think sin is violation of conscience, right? If we're talking about sin in the full moral sense of the term, right? You know, that sin's an analogous word, and so you can talk about, you know, lesser analogous, not strictly moral, not
really
moral, right? But if we're talking about real moral sin, you know, I think that sin can be defined. Formal sin is defined as a violation of conscience, a deliberate violation of conscience, right? You know that something's wrong and you do it anyway. I mean, I realize that's not Aquinas' definition, but I think that it's a good description. I think that it's I think it's implied by his definition. So I think, you know, believing something is wrong and deliberately choosing to do it constitutes sin. I think that is what an evil act is. Again, if we're using evil in its sort of fullest moral sense. But then if we're going to say, well, what's required for understanding that an act is wrong, right? Because, you know, what is it that informs conscience? What does it mean to grasp an act as fully evil? I think that our understanding of what makes an act wrong is precisely that it is depriving something of another, or rather depriving another of his due. I think that all sin is injustice. And to recognize yourself as under some sort of obligation, whether a positive or a negative obligation, is to recognize that you owe something to someone.
That's okay. So I was trying to get an account of good and evil, and you had just started by giving an account of obligation. And when I asked you for the account of good and evil, you brought it back to obligation.
Because we're talking about moral. If we're talking about good in a moral sense, you can't. I don't think you can really separate the two entirely.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe this is a good point to raise a question that I've had about obligation in general and St. Thomas's view of natural law. You know how he says in question 94, the prima secunda, that good is that which ought to be done. That's the first principle of the practical intellect. That's, you know, pertaining to morals. So the Latin bonum faciendum est. Uh-huh. And it seems then this gerundive suggests obligation right there from the beginning. So the first principle of our action is in some sense already deontological, is the way that I understand that. I'm not sure others do, but it does seem to me that when we're talking about morality in the realm of practical actions, we do in a sense start with obligation. So it's not necessarily wrong for William to be thinking in those terms. If you sin, it's against an obligation that you have. But for me, we also have to include our nature and our natural inclinations and see that it's happy. It would make us happy and it would fulfill us if we live in accordance with nature. So therefore, sin is also that which is contrary to our nature in some sense, because it acts against that which would fulfill us. Why? Because God is the author of our nature. And he made us in such a way to be happy and to be good. So, but what do you think?
Can I come back to that? Oh, go ahead.
I think that that's a helpful distinction, helpful point, Ryan, because it's helping me see the issue that I'm having. And the issue that I'm having with what William is saying is this: I'm trying to expand the concept of what counts as an evil action or as a bad action, because I think it's possible to say that an action is both bad and not a sin. So you can consider, I'll take a biblical example, the midwives in Egypt lying to Pharaoh, right? Did they sin? I don't think so. I don't think so precisely because God ends up rewarding them for their action. At the same time, by natural law of reasoning, for Aquinas himself, and using the perverted faculty argument, lying is always wrong and you shouldn't ever do it. But he says that they didn't realize that lying was wrong. They didn't know that lying was wrong. So to William's point about acting against your conscience, they very much were not. They were acting in accord with their conscience. And consequently, I can say in accord with his definition, William's definition of a sin, that they didn't sin, but the action was evil. So that's why I was trying to push the conversation that way, because that shows you that, I guess that makes clear the connection between the goodness or evilness of our actions and the perverted faculty argument, which helps us understand whether we should do them or not.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just kind of pondering. I had never heard that, read that in Aquinas talking about that sin not being, or that action of lying not being a sin. That is very fascinating. So God then judges us based off of our conscience, which is a law. Conscience is called a law by St. Thomas. So it's like the proximate law that you know, is synderesis, or the natural law is like the primary law, and then conscience applies it. And then so if we have a certain understanding of natural law, even if it's wrong, and we follow our consciences, then we're not sinning, and then that's what God is going to judge us on. That's pretty fascinating. But I think we could still say their actions were wrong. Why? Because they're acting contrary to the purpose of their faculty. God gave us the faculty of speech in order to tell the truth, in order to speak truth and communicate it.
Right. And I would, there's another distinction to draw, because Aquinas says that the midwives did not sin, he doesn't go so far as to say that their action was meritorious, which is kind of interesting, because Alphonsus does. St. Alphonsus would say that you can perform an intrinsically evil action, but if you don't know, if you're invincibly ignorant of its intrinsic evil status and you perform it out of charity, then it's a meritorious action. Whereas Aquinas thinks that that kind of action, although it isn't a sin, it's incapable of being ordered by charity out of love of God. And so it isn't meritorious, but it also isn't a sin.
So Aquinas explicitly says it's not meritorious?
I have a lot of difficulty with that. I've seen a lot of arguments for the case, trying to make the case in Aquinas that that is a meritorious action, and they all fail spectacularly. Aquinas is super, I don't know, his stuff on conscience is so short that it's difficult to tease him out on that. But the overall received opinion that I trust in interpretation of Aquinas is that isn't a meritorious action.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. I would disagree, actually. I mean, because if it's not a mortal sin, if you're not doing something that for you is mortal, even if objectively it is, then you're still living in a state of life that allows you to merit when you do things that are good in some way. And if you're doing something that you think is good, then it seems like it would be the cause of merit. Yeah, it's interesting.
It is an interesting question.
It's a great, one of my friends likes to say that every theological debate is actually about nature and grace.
And yeah.
Now we've gotten there.
Yeah, I hesitate to comment on that one without thinking about it. But yeah, the distinction between material and formal sin, which it seems to me is what we've been kind of talking about, is certainly it's important. You know, you can do something that's objectively wrong, objectively contrary to law, but if for whatever reason your conscience is malformed and you sincerely, and not because of some willful ignorance or something like that, but you sincerely believe that it's not wrong, it's not formal sin, and you're not, ignorance excuses. At the end of the day, the most that can be asked of us is, this gets back to the intellectual determinism question that we dealt with a year ago, right? Like, the principle of morality is ultimately the will, and intellectual error does not constitute sin, assuming it's a genuine intellectual error and not a willful error. The most that we can be asked to do is what we believe is right.
It's kind of funny. I just for the basis of comparison, St. Bonaventure says that if you do something that you're mistaken about the morality of, you do something wrong thinking that it's right, then you sin mortally because you've broken the divine law. But if you do something right thinking that it's wrong, you still sin mortally because you've now acted against your conscience.
Wait, what was the first case?
So you do something wrong thinking that it's right for Bonaventure.
And Bonaventure says that's
immortal. So consider the midwives, right? I mean, but let's consider their lie a more pernicious one, and they think it's right.
Right.
They've sinned because they violated the divine law, even though they didn't know. For Aquinas, the other example is that they do something that actually is right. It's a good thing in terms of its moral species, but they think that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Now they've sinned because they violated their conscience, which is approximate norm for morality. So that's Bonaventure. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Yeah. Aquinas, if you do something that you think is wrong, you've sinned.
Right.
And if you do something that you think is right and you should have known better, then you sin. But if you do something that you think is right and there's no way for you to have known better, I actually find him more ambiguous on that question.
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering that like there is an analogy in the term sin, and it has some fuzzy meanings, and particularly in the medievals, I think sometimes it's worth. They're not always clear about how they're using sin. Right? I mean, like.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing in regard to Bonaventure. I was wondering if maybe he's using sin, the costume, in a different way. Sometimes they use it as fault And maybe he's just saying it would be a fault, but it wouldn't actually be a sin. You know, I'm not sure, Matthew, if you've read it that closely to know.
He says, I mean, he says mortal. He says mortal sin.
Mortal. No, okay. Pretty, well, there
pretty,
you go.
Ambiguous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's definitely been a development or a change of language too. You know, even in the Renaissance, the terms sin and mortal sin and so forth aren't always clearly delineated between the objective and the subjective or the material and the formal, as we would say today. And one thing just to keep in mind in the background of all this is that in Latin, the word peccatum is much more polyvalent than it is in than sin is in English. In English, sin has a clear moral connotation. In Latin, peccatum is any kind of missing the mark. A grammatical mistake is a peccatum, for example. Right. If an arrow is aimed at a target and it misses, it's a peccatum.
Yeah. Right, right.
So then, I would say that any misuse of the faculty is a peccatum.
In a vague sense.
In that sense.
Just trying to bring it back.
So
yeah, no, it's fair to bring it back. So go ahead.
Can I actually jump in, William, just to, because yeah. I just want to figure out what this argument is. I don't know much about it. The title there or whatever, the perverted faculty argument. So is the right. faculty itself then said to be perverted, or does that mean when we say perverted faculty, is it saying it's a perversion of the faculty when the yeah. faculty is used in a way that's contra naturam?
The latter.
Yeah, the second one.
As I understand.
It's just
it, yeah.
a perversion of the faculty. Okay, so it's shorthand right. for that.
So it's when right. one perverts one's faculty.
Because I guess you could also develop, if you continually acted in a way that was contrary to nature, you could actually pervert your faculty such that you habitually
right.
come to be ordered in the wrong way.
Well, it's yeah. an interesting question to me. I'm not sure it's possible. Is it possible to use a faculty for that which, like, for its opposite? You know, is it possible to use, I mean, because you always choose the good under the guise, I'm sorry, you always choose under the guise of good, right? So could you use your will to choose something purely evil? No.
No.
Right. You can't do that. Can you use your intellect in a way that makes, I don't even know how, what's the opposite of truth?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, I don't even think that's possible.
Well, yeah. And it's, you know, it's worth remembering that evil isn't exactly the opposite of good. It's a corruption of the good.
Exactly.
It's opposed to the good, but it's right. It's right. Evil is opposed to the good, but it's opposed by being a corruption of it or contradicting the fullness of the good, not by being the exact same kind of thing, only in the opposite sense.
Right.
So that's actually very helpful then, right? Because if somebody habitually performs an action that is evil in some way, let's say it's an intellectual a sin, and in order to commit a sin, you have to justify it. So once you have a practical syllogism at a certain part of the syllogism, your appetites, you know, get in the way, and you have a faulty middle term or something. And if after a while you keep giving into this action that is one in which you've justified your action because you have a false practical syllogism, then you could start thinking the wrong way habitually and start to justify an action that is bad as good. But you would do so because you're saying it's good in some way to you. So it wouldn't be the opposite of like truth, because actually anything we do for ourselves is good for us in some way. So it's not the opposite.
At least apparently.
It's a perversion of the truth when you try to justify something and say, okay, I'm going to do this because it's good in this way. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
So sometimes in discussions about the perverted faculty argument, a distinction is made. And Matthew, you mentioned this earlier, or at least alluded to it, between things that are contrary to the faculty and things that are just other than the faculty's built-in purpose. So, you know, in Latin, the distinction between contra naturam and praeter naturam. And that seems to me to be a helpful distinction. And it seems that there are such things. We certainly can use our different capacities in a way that might be other than their obvious or manifest built-in purpose, like walking on one's hands, for example, that doesn't seem to be harmful to or contradictory to that purpose. But does that distinction always apply? Can we apply that to every faculty? Is that the best way to get around some of the objections to this argument?
Yeah, I think that's how, I mean, the easiest example, I think, is with the faculty of speech. Lying is bad, but equivocation isn't necessarily bad. It isn't necessarily good either, because it's praetor naturum, not contra naturum. Or with respect to generation, one could talk about contraception versus the practice of natural family planning to being used to avoid children, right? Which may or may not be good according to humani vitae, depending on why you're doing it. Contraception is never to be chosen, but you know, deliberately abstaining from sex in order to avoid having children by itself isn't contrary to nature. It's just not doing something. So the question then becomes, well, why are you doing it?
Right. Well, yeah, but that wouldn't be an example of using a faculty praetor naturum. It would be an example of choosing to use a faculty or not use it.
I guess, okay, so the equivocation example is better then, yeah.
But wait, I thought that was an interesting thing to think about, though. Isn't it possible that we could say that that natural family planning is somehow like praetor naturum, because it's certainly not something people would do naturally? You have to have some kind of strange circumstance to act that way.
Well, I guess that's true, because you could be using the generative faculty when you know that your wife is infertile. So in fact, you are using the faculty, and you're using it in a way that is praetor naturum. I guess so.
Well, not necessarily, because the act itself, the sexual act itself, retains its integrity.
That's true. That is true.
And isn't that why it's not contrary to nature?
Yeah, the act itself is not changed.
Maybe we can make it a third term. There's contra naturum. Maybe there's indifferentia. There's indifferent with respect to nature. And then there's in accord with nature. So telling the truth, I mean, speaking for the sake of communicating the truth, that's the best thing you can do with your faculty of speech. You can speak without sinning, but not necessarily say anything that's true either. Right. But when you speak, but the reason why it was given to you isn't just why God gave you that faculty. It wasn't just to speak, it's to speak the truth. So that's in accord with nature, speaking the truth. Then there's equivocation, saying something that's deliberately ambiguous. And you're not trying to deceive anybody or anything. You're just saying something ambiguous and everyone knows it's ambiguous. That's not really in accord with your nature in itself. But it's not really against your nature either. But then lying is something that is directly contrary to the social nature of man, because it disrupts the social fabric of society. So it's unjust. So maybe we could use a third category. Not to get too much, you know, like a nominalist, just come up with like 15 different distinctions with respect to a single act.
It seems a little bit difficult to think through, because the faculties that we're talking about are also different. You know, if we're going to think about the human person in terms of faculties, so in terms of systems or capacities or powers or things like that, these things are also different. Speech versus generation versus whatever their examples you want to think of. How easy is it to determine whether there is one built-in purpose for these faculties and what that might be versus other things? Because, for example, someone might well argue that the purpose of the sexual faculty is just as much pleasure or companionship or whatever as procreation. And how are we to determine which is which, especially in a morally binding way?
Well, that's, I think why I at the beginning, I drew a distinction between the physiological functions of the body and the powers of the soul, because I think it's much easier to determine what the end of a power of the soul is. I think there's one ambiguous example that goes along with what you were saying that came up a few years ago on the blog, Just Thomism. People were talking about, well, what is the function of the lungs? Because one person tried to argue, well, the function of the lungs is to absorb oxygen from the air, and so smoking is bad. And another person said, no, the function of the lungs is gas exchange. Right. But which gases, you know? So I think something like that would be much better put in terms of the nutritive faculty of the soul, which would include physiologically both digestion and respiration. And consequently, if we look at it that way, then it can be very easy to say something like, well, nutritious food is good for you. Diet soda is okay, but probably not good, maybe not that bad either. And then, you know, drinking bleach, well, that's obviously a bad thing because that's directly contrary to the faculty of nutrition.
Gas exchange. I was going to say, if it's just the absorption of oxygen, you know, you couldn't use general anesthesia or other things like that as well, I suppose.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, you'd have a lot of problems there.
So this gets back to something you mentioned at the beginning about physicalism or the charge of physicalism. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I think the best example of physicalism that I've ever encountered was in a theological article that I read a while ago, but it was from, I don't remember the exact year, but it was kind of around the time of Humani Vitae. And the author of the article was trying to argue that Humani Vitae needed to be interpreted in a much stricter way than people were taking it, because what he said was condoms are obviously bad because they introduce a barrier into the sexual act, but hormonal contraception is clearly not bad because it doesn't disturb the integrity of the act. So the act retains its integrity, and that's perfectly fine. But to us today, it's pretty clear that Humani Vitae should not be taken in such a way, and we do clearly oppose the use of the contraceptive pill. So that what that author was doing was he was taking a physiological function, or even just a biological structure, really, and endowing that with moral normativity. Which I don't think we want to do. And you can see Aquinas use something like the perverted faculty argument when dealing with a similar problem. The problem that he's dealing with is fornication, not contraception, but still having to do with sex. And I think it's book one of the Summa Contra Gentiles, chapter 122, but don't quote me on that. But if you look at it, his argument isn't just zeroing in on a faculty. It's focusing much more broadly on what generation does and how it works, and not just the mechanics of it, but its overall effects on people and on society as a whole. So one of the things he says is that you should not, you know, attempt to procreate unless you also have the means at your disposal of rearing and educating children. That would just be irresponsible. So the perverted faculty argument, if that's in fact what he's using, is actually applied using a very broad logic like that.
And that makes sense. That would be more in line with the natural inclination to procreation taken in its holistic human context, which is not just literally the biological function of begetting children, but the entire process of raising them and educating them for their own good in terms of their own last end, as well as the common good of society.
Right.
Yeah. Fazer has a good piece on the perverted faculty argument where he gets into this. And I think I found that aspect of it interesting, because it's clear that we're not just, the argument is not from the point of view of a physicalism that is easily dismissed, because even if it is kind of physicalistic, he's saying, let's look at the way that we are ordered by our inclinations. And we can see that, yes, the end or the teleology of the procreative act of having relations with another, with the person of the other sex, is going to lead to procreation. But also he points out, well, we have these other inclinations in us. We have an inclination to attain to unity. And so the procreative and the unitive ends go together in some sense, even if the procreative is first. And since we have this desire for union with another person, that's going to include then embracing them on the other side of the pregnancy. So the woman's going to get pregnant. And if you love her and you're ordered towards her, feel drawn towards her, you're going to want to be there to nourish her and provide for her and your children. So that's all part, it's all built into the way that we're wired, you know?
And that latter example even shows just how broadly Aquinas applies the perverted faculty argument, because he actually considers the case, because you talked about providing for your wife when she's pregnant. And Aquinas actually considers the example of a woman who doesn't need a man to do that because she's for very wealthy, for example. And he goes, well, just because, you know, most women would have to rely on a husband, not necessarily all of them do, would it be okay then for those women to then try and rear a child without being married to a man? And he says, no, because that isn't how it works in general. And since this is the generative faculty, it's a, in a sense, it has public weight, so to speak. It has consequences for society based on how one uses it. So there's no such thing as the privacy of the bedroom, and morally speaking, right? So yeah. What that means is that we can't legislate that way. Otherwise, we'd have to come up with a law for every single individual person. The law has to apply generally. Therefore, no, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, good.
So you see, just when he's talking about the faculty of generation, he doesn't just mean it makes babies, therefore it should do such. He means, well, it makes babies and that matters a lot. And here are all the implications, and therefore here are all the rules that you should follow with respect to them. So the perverted faculty argument is actually very robust and broad in its logic.
Yeah, like it's the marital act is ordered towards having children, or the sexual act is ordered towards having children, but we don't just stop there. What is the point of having children?
Right.
It's for their upbringing as well, to raise other rational souls who will live in keeping with reason and live good lives. And the only way to bring that about is to be there for them afterwards and to have a family unit that's going to allow the family to thrive, you know, and that's all kind of implied by the way that our holistic natural inclinations direct us.
And then from what you just said, it follows pretty readily that therefore marriage should be between a man and a woman, and that it should be permanent and exclusive, and so on.
Yeah. Objections, William?
Good. So we're done.
Well, I don't want to derail your hashing all this out, but when this is reaches a breaking point, I'd like to go back and press the point on the validity of the form of the argument in general. I mean, we've sort of been, you know, presuming that it basically works, and of course I don't agree with that. But I noticed, okay, two things I just occurred to me while I was listening to you. Matthew, a while back, you mentioned just in passing, God gave you speech for a reason, right? You were talking about how lying is against faculty of speech. And I think that when we introduce that premise, okay, you know, you thought of that as a throwaway line or, you know, something not very sophisticated, not carrying any real weight. But I think when you add that, that changes the nature of the argument fundamentally. Mm. Because remember, you know, when I went back, I said, you know, I think that at root, what recognition, awareness of an obligation is at root recognizing that you owe something to another, right? I think that that's what it means for us to recognize that we're obligated. And, you know, when you introduce God as author of nature into that argument, you know, God who has dominion over us, that I think that changes the argument, and that opens up the possibility of being valid. And this isn't totally crazy. You know, 1 Corinthians 6, starting at verse 18, I think, right? Paul says, fly fornication. And what's the reason that he gives? He says, you're not your own. You were bought with a price, right? And I think, you know, once we introduce the idea that we are not our own, that we belong to another, that completely changes the moral significance of our faculties, of our bodily faculties.
So what you're saying is that I accidentally made the argument valid?
Yeah, basically. But you know, I think that it completely changes. You know, if you take out the idea of God, or if you have an idea of God as this kind of abstract being, and if you take away the idea that you belong to something, you know, even a human community that's bigger than yourself, and belong to it in a sense that you can actually owe things to it. Like it has a real claim on you in yourself. If you take that idea away, you know, you can make an argument that, you know, well, sexual immorality is not really, you know, it's abusing your own faculties and it's probably not going to make you happy. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to get you to a real obligation, right? It's going to get you to sort of a, well, this is probably the best way to live your life. And I don't think that's the same as a moral obligation. I think that's a fundamentally different kind of thing, right? That's a counsel. That's a prudential concern about how to make yourself happy. And I think that's something, you know, I think that's a different category from saying this is right and you must act this way.
Well, I think that that's a helpful point to have made, because I didn't see myself to be making a particularly significant point. Not that I thought it was unsophisticated, but that I just thought it was obvious. I thought that it was already implied in everything else that I was already saying. So what that means is that I thought there was an implicit premise that I thought was clearly there that you didn't see there. And I guess what I'm about to do might show my departure from neo-Thomism just a little bit. But I think that the concept, for example, of pure nature is helpful, but purely hypothetical. And, you know, because there is no single existing human being who has not existed in some economy of grace, mm-hmm. either integral nature before the fall, fallen nature afterwards, redeemed after that. And so consequently, every single action that we have affects our relationship with God in some way. And so there's more at stake here than does this affect my happiness on a natural level? Because you could hypothetically say, well, if God didn't exist and we simply existed like this, then it might in fact be the case that so-and-so over there derives happiness from doing this, and that's okay for him, but it's not okay for me. But we have divine revelation to help us out, and we know that certain things won't make us happy, even if we're very confused and we think that they will. And we also know that ultimately what makes us happy is our relationship with God. And if that relationship with God, if anything we do is going to harm that, then that is not in accord with our happiness. So I guess I've just kind of supernaturalized the problem, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
I don't think there's any need to bring grace into it. You know, we would have obligations to God, whether we'd been elevated to the state of grace or not. Not to mention the fact that, you know, whenever you begin a hypothetical with if God didn't exist, you can add anything you want after that. So
that's precisely William's point, right?
Well, God is the root of all reality and all being. And, you know, therefore, anything that has any kind of being or reality to it, including obligation.
Sure.
Right. But, you know, you said that's that premise that I picked up on is something that you take as really obvious. And I'm not going after you. But when you see the perverted faculty argument expressed, that premise is, as far as I'm aware, never included. Like, that's not part of the argument. The argument is always, and now it's always about, you know, you as an individual and your nature and what's going to be perfected of your nature. And my point is, that's not what obligation's about. That's not what, and people aren't going to recognize it, right? Like, you can create a morality and an ethical system where you say, well, what ethics is really about and what you're really obligated to do is to make yourself happy or to fulfill yourself. And I mean, you can do that, but it's not going to, I don't think that's going to carry any purchase when you start using that with real people and you go up to them and you say, well, look, you know, I know what's going to make you happy. And I'm going to tell you what's going to make you happy. You may or not, believe me. And by the way, you're obligated to do what's going to make you happy. And if you don't do what's going to make you happy, you're sinning. That's not how we use the term. That's not how we think about it. And the reason we don't think about it that way, I think, well, we don't think about it that way. I'm setting aside Thomist ethicists because they tend to think about it precisely that way. But the reason that humans don't think about obligation in terms of what's going to make us happy is because I think that they're two fundamentally different concepts, right? In human experience, what I'm obliged to do is quite often perceived to be in conflict with what I want to do, with what I think is going to make me happy, with what I think is going to be advantageous. That's why people commonly have an experience of moral struggle, right? Where we think this is going to make me happy, but we're also aware that it's wrong. You know, when we have the opportunity to gain at somebody else's cost, when we have the opportunity to, you know, do somebody wrong, in order for us to get ahead and to get what we really want, you know, that's a struggle precisely because from that person's perspective, and that person's perspective may be wrong, but for him, conceptually, what's going to make him happy is something different from what he believes and knows to be right. So I think we have to keep those two separate, or else we're not doing justice to human psychology, human moral psychology.
I mean, I think you should just out yourself as a SCOTUS.
A SCOTUS?
Maybe not.
I was expecting a conscience, but
well, what I'm hearing is Anselm. Anselm argued that the will didn't have one fundamental inclination toward the good, rather two: one towards happiness and one towards justice.
Right.
And that's kind of what I'm hearing. Like, oh well, you know, regardless of what makes me happy, this is my obligation over here. Well, then the question that naturally arises is, well, then what's the point of following the obligation? Because God's going to punish you if you don't.
No. So I think that in you know, humans, we have multiple inclinations. Of course, our will, you know, was ordered to the good, secundum rationem, or whatever, and you know, it can be swayed by all sorts of other, you know, it can be swayed by all sorts of other apprehensions. You know, yeah. our sense appetites can influence our will. You know, as anybody who's lived has experienced. You know, so we've got a bunch of inclinations, but among those inclinations, Aquinas is perfectly clear, one of them is precisely to live according to reason. And yes. So once you recognize that something's obligatory, once reason tells you this is the right thing to do, it would be simply irrational to steal from this person, to murder this person. Right. You are depriving him of what is his, period. At that point, you can say, well, it's also good for me, right? It may not be what I want, but it's good for me because it is rational and I have a desire to live according to reason. And you can see that desire to live according to reason in the pangs of conscience, right? We experience knowledge of our own moral guilt as painful because it's a frustration of a natural desire that we have.
Is there an obligation to live according to reason, William?
I mean, I is there an obligation to live according to reason? I feel like at that point, there's something like redundant going on where it's like, according to reason is already built into the notion of obligation.
You think obligations are self-imposing then?
Well, no, that's precisely what I'm trying to get away from having to say. Is there an obligation to live according to reason? I mean, I think there's an inclination to live according to reason. And I think that reason is precisely the source of obligation. So, I mean, I guess there could be an obligation to live according to reason in the sense of like, don't deliberately deceive yourself or something like that. But I mean, I'm trying to analyze the expression.
It just seems to me that when we see that something's right, yeah, we're going to say this is something I ought to do. And if we don't follow what we perceive as right, we will have a pang of conscience, like you said. But I don't think we need to bring God into it to have this consideration. In the Nicomachean Ethics, you know, the definition of virtue is a habit as chosen, existing in the middle of two extremes, in accordance with right reason. And I think that right reason is guiding us in a sense that we perceive that it's something we ought to follow. So virtue is going to be in keeping with obligation. And absolutely. So I think Aristotle might go around and say to people, hey, this is, I know you might not believe me, but I can tell you what's good for you is to be virtuous. And you might not believe me, but you should actually be virtuous and you have a duty to be virtuous. He wouldn't add the part about sin, but he could say that. And so for me, it's like we're wired by nature to follow our reason, but we're also bound to follow it. Why? Because the good ought to be done. And when we perceive something as good, then we ought to do it. We perceive it by our reason. I don't know. I don't even know if that helps. I'm just, that's the way I think of things anyway.
Well, throughout this whole discussion, you know, there's a distinction to be made between the ultimate speculative foundations of things and the way we practically operate most of the time. And we can apply this in purely theoretical things and non-practical matters as well. So, for example, I can do the science of physics or of biology without thinking about God, but ultimately those sciences are possible because God does exist and God is the source of the real beings that I'm studying and the source of my ability to know them. You know, similarly, I might be able to make all kinds of moral decisions on the basis of conscience without thinking about the eternal law, but the eternal law is the ultimate basis for the binding authority of my conscience and of whatever real insight I have into the good. So I think that, we do have an obligation to live in accordance with reason. Ultimately, that comes from God, just like everything else does, everything else that's real and that has any kind of being in it. And in a way, there are two sides of the same coin. Then we have an obligation to obey God, but the end God has set for us is some kind of union with himself, whether on a natural level or a supernatural level. And we're going to find happiness and enjoyment. In fact, it's union with God that we just call beatitude or happiness. Now, William made a very interesting point about the way the perverted faculty argument is often presented. And I think he's right about that. And it may be suggestive of a shift that's occurred kind of in the popular consciousness over the last decades. I wonder whether the perverted faculty argument was used in the past without mentioning this implicit premise that ultimately we have an obligation to act in accordance with our nature and the built-in purposes of our faculties, because that's what God has chosen for us or God has willed for us in creating us as we are. I wonder if that premise was omitted because in the past, people were more likely to respond to an argument that showed them why acting in a certain way would be good for them. So it was more of an appeal to people's natural desire for happiness. Whereas possibly today, things may have shifted to the point where people would even value radical freedom over their own well-being. You know, maybe today people have a stronger sense that I should be able to do what I want, even if it's bad for me. And so what? So maybe the apologetic value needs to shift a little bit.
I mean, I think the premise was omitted just because you have to start somewhere. We can't start with, well, the first thing the intellect understands about anything is that it exists. Premise one, and then reason all the way to, therefore you shouldn't fornicate.
Yeah, I'm right. I mean, speculatively, you could do that, but that's not where most people start. I mean, in fact, many people come to know the existence of God by way of conscience.
Right. True.
You know,
I think that I don't want to derail this and make the whole conversation about me and my very particular theories and interpretations of Aquinas, but I feel like I may not have been sufficiently clear. The reason that I feel that particular premise is so important is, again, that I think we do not grasp obligation. We do not grasp something as law simply because we see that it is good for us or that it is completive of our nature, or because it is in accordance with our teleology. You know, that's not what makes us grasp something as obligatory. That's not what makes us see it as part of the natural law. What makes us see that something is part of the natural law, what makes us see that we are bound in conscience to do or not do something, is relational. This is my thesis. I have not defended this thesis tonight. I have elsewhere, and I can try to do it tonight if necessary. But anyway, it is precisely relational, right? Let me illustrate for a second. If I say to you, you owe it to yourself to get your drinking under control, I'm counseling you. I'm telling you what's prudent. If I tell you, you owe it to your family to get your drinking under control, right? Immediately, intuitively, I'm making a fundamentally different kind of claim, right? I'm, you know, if I gave you the first advice and I said, you know, you owe it to yourself to get your drinking under control. If you said, you know what, you're right, and then you went out and you started drinking again, we'd say you're a fool. You're an idiot, right? Like, you shouldn't, come on, what are you doing? If I gave you the second sort of advice, I said, you owe it to your family to get your drinking under control. You owe it to your kids. You owe it to your wife. And you said, you know what, you're right, I do. And I went out and bought a fifth. I wouldn't think that you're foolish. I think you're wicked, right? I think you're evil, right? You're hurting other people. That's humans, you go out and you start talking to people and people distinguish very naturally between the imprudent, things that they perceive as being harmful to themselves only or to the agent only. You know, you go out and you do something stupid and you wreck your car, not hurting anybody else, just destroying your car, right? You're out of car. You don't take care of your clothes and you go get this really expensive wardrobe and you ruin it, or you act like a fool in a job interview and you miss the job, whatever, right? This stuff is imprudent. Most, this is a common sense, you know, folk ethic distinction. You know, this is the realm of the imprudent. When you start doing things where you're deliberately, selfishly hurting other people, that's when people start saying you're bad. You're wicked. You're violating your obligation, right? And that's a really important distinction, again, in the way people naturally think about ethics. And I think that distinction is in Aquinas. And again, I can defend that if you want me to. How did I get here? The reason I got here is because when we start talking about the perverted faculty argument, you know, it keeps coming up, you know, like you know, this idea that, well, these are your faculties have purpose and you need to do what's good in accordance with your nature, what's going to be completed with your nature. And my point is that is irrelevant to determining what is obligatory as such, right? When you consider it as such, that's not relevant. You know, yeah, it might end up being relevant when you come back around the corner, but to get to that point, you've got to see that you belong to another, right? When you see, oh, I owe it to my wife, or I owe it to the human species, or I owe it to God. God gave me these faculties for a reason. And specifically, and you know, if you go back and you read, you know, mid 20th century ethicists, you know, Catholic bioethicists, you know, they'll say that, you know, your sexual faculty in particular, it's yours, but it's actually not yours. it's yours to use, but it's given to you not for your own good, but for somebody else's good, and it's aimed toward the good of another. And so, you know, you're sort of the custodian of it, and you can decide whether to use it or not. But because it's not for your good, and it's, you know, somebody else has a claim on you, so to speak, you know, there are limits to how that can be exercised. Anyway, my point is that you don't get to obligation, I would argue, until you bring in someone else who has a claim on you. And so just saying, this is good for you, this is going to fulfill your nature, this is going to complete you, this is going to make you happy, that's not going to get the person to recognize an obligation.
I just don't see those different things. Converting the faculty argument, I mean, perverting some faculty is bad because it's against your nature. And it also does all those things that you mentioned. I mean, Aquinas has a strong thesis about the unity of the virtues. So you're saying, you know, I would say that's imprudent, but it's not wicked. But Aquinas would say it is wicked. Because if it's not prudent, then it's not just either. Right?
Right. But yeah, yes, in fact, the virtues are unified, but there are specific links between them. Like there are ways that they end up interlocking such that you have to have them. And you know, in the case of, you know, imprudence and injustice, like, yes, what's bad for me does end up being bad for others. But I can only see that once I see, or it does end up being unjust, but I can only see that what's imprudent is also unjust once I see myself relationally. Once I see that I belong to someone else, then what hurts me also is depriving someone else of something that's his due. All right. I've been prattling on, so I'll.
Well, we've touched on a number of other topics that we could certainly discuss in future podcasts, you know, even the ultimate foundations of morality, not to mention reality itself. So we talked a little bit today about the perverted faculty argument, some versions of it, some pros and cons for how it's been presented most commonly. And we thank you all for listening. Hopefully we'll be able to continue this discussion on some of the other topics that we raised today. This has been Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project. You can find us online at sacradoctrinaproject.org.